The headlines: Iran's president says a resistance is the only way to stop Israel's savagery and aggression. North Korea denies that it has provided weapons to Russia, rejecting U.S. claims that it is doing so. And a new report says skyrocketing costs of renting a house in the U.S. is forcing young workers to take on additional jobs. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories of this hour. Iran's president says Lebanon has proved that resistance is the only way to stop the Zionist regime's savagery and aggression. Ibrahim Raisi made these remarks in a meeting with Lebanon's Prime Minister Najib Mikati on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly meeting. He said those who thought Israel could be countered without resistance have realized their error and are mending their ways. Raisi stressed that normalization of relations with some regional countries will not bring security to Israel, but only deepens a regional people's hatred of the regime. The Iranian president also touched on Lebanon's internal politics, saying all ethnic and religious groups in the country must unite to create a powerful government. Raisi said Iran attaches great importance to security and peace in Lebanon. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi calls for the prosecution of former U.S. President Donald Trump for ordering the assassination of top General Qasem Soleimani.
The fair pursuit of justice in the face of the crime the former American president admitted to is serving the humanity. We will seek through a fair tribunal to bring to justice those who ordered and those who committed the martyrdom of our beloved General Qasem Soleimani.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, Raisi underlined that the Islamic Republic will legally pursue the U.S. assassination of the anti-terror icon. He also hailed Iran's role for confronting high-handed and interventionist policies, including, quote, U.S.-crafted terrorism. Elsewhere in his speech, Raisi strongly condemned the West for applying double standards when it comes to the human rights issue. He said those supporting rights violations and terrorism must be held to account. Iranian president also stressed the need for multilateralism, saying it has far-reaching significance for a just world. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg from Toronto says raising the issue of General Qasem Soleimani's assassination at the UN General Assembly was a positive step.
Well, I think it's an excellent move on President Raisi's part. This was outrageous, and it was ignored by the world. It was just disappeared, assassination of a senior official. So I don't know if the UN can do much, but it's worthwhile just to keep the world aware of who the real terrorists are in the world. Biden spoke out against terrorism and to support Ukraine, but his version of terrorism is completely the reverse of the real terrorism going on, which is predominantly by the U.S. itself. So it's good that at least Iran is not afraid to stand up at the U.N. and call things as they are. So that is a very, very positive sign out of the UN General Assembly.
Journalist and author Daniel Lazar says the U.S. has gone to great lengths to protect its global hegemonic status.
The demise of the Soviet Union in 1991 essentially left the U.S. as the sole remaining superpower, and the U.S. has done its best to to make the most of that, of its status, by imposing its rules on all other countries, or doing its best to, and tolerating absolutely no dissent. So, you know, so a country like Iran finds itself, you know, under attack by America, under ceaseless attack. I mean, its scientists are killed, its top generals are assassinated, it's subject to a brutal economic blockade. And it just goes to show how fundamentally intolerant the American hegemon really is. And other countries which run afoul of America, Nicaragua, for example, Venezuela, or certainly Russia, receive the same treatment. And this kind of unilateral assertion of American power, can only lead to confrontation and war. There simply is no way out of a military showdown.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says major world powers tried to topple the Islamic Republic by supporting former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remarks on the occasion of Iran's Sacred Defense Week. He said that world powers at the time could not tolerate a new independent country. That is why they decided to wage a war on Iran through a power-thirsty man who was at the helm in neighboring Iraq. He noted that Iranians, however, managed to append enemies' plots through their resistance. The leader even said that the war was a bitter experience, but Iranians were able to turn that threat into new opportunities by emboldening the domestic military and defense capabilities. Iraq waged an 8-year war against Iran only a year after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. During the war, Iraq was fully supported by the U.S. and its allies, while the same countries denied Iran access to foreign arms. North Korea has denied U.S. allegations that it is providing arms to Russia. Pyongyang says it has never supplied weapons or ammunition to Moscow and does not plan to do so in the future. North Korean media quoted a senior defense ministry official saying that such reports are rumors spread by the U.S. and other hostile forces. The official warned the U.S. to keep its mouth shut and stop circulating rumors aimed at tarnishing North Korea's image. Pyongyang's reaction came after a U.S. State Department spokesperson said earlier this month that Russia is in the process of purchasing rockets and artillery shells from North Korea for use in Ukraine. The White House spokesperson later called that a potential purchase. John Kirby added that there were no indications that the purchase had been completed and certainly no indications that those weapons were being used in Ukraine. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has urged the United Nations to punish Russia for its offensive against his country. Speaking via video to the UN General Assembly annual summit, Zelensky said Russia has violated the principles of the world body. He also called for the establishment of a special tribunal to hold Russia accountable for its military offensive against Ukraine. Zelensky called for a fund to compensate Ukrainians for the damage they suffered during the war. The Ukrainian president also urged the UN to strip Russia of its veto power at the Security Council. Zelensky said Kiev had a plan with 5 non-negotiable conditions to establish a durable peace. The plan includes punishment for Russian aggression, resorting to a restoration of Ukraine's territorial integrity and security guarantees. He also rejected any suggestions that Kiev should adopt neutrality. U.S. President Joe Biden has accused Russia of violating core tenets of the UN Charter by launching a war on Ukraine.
Russia has shamelessly violated the core tenets of the United Nations Charter, no more important than the clear prohibition against countries taking the territory of their neighbor by force.
Speaking at the UN General Assembly, Biden also criticized what he called reckless nuclear threats by his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. In his speech, the American president vowed to continue supporting Kiev in the face of Russian military campaign. He claimed that Washington wants the Ukraine war to end on just terms, that after Putin warned the West that Moscow would use all available means to respond to threats against his country's territorial integrity.
Washington, London, and Brussels are directly pushing Kiev to transfer military operations to our territory. They no longer hide the fact that Russia must be defeated by all means on the battlefield, followed by the provision of political, economic, cultural, and any kind of sovereignty, with complete plundering of our country. Nuclear blackmail is also used.
In a televised address, Putin noted that Moscow has enough for weapons to counter any threats, insisting that this is not just a bluff. He said Russia's operations in Ukraine, aimed at liberating the Donbas region, is because most of the people there don't want to return to what he called the yoke of Ukraine. Putin also ordered Russia's first mobilization since World War II. Russia's defense minister says the partial mobilization will likely add 300,000 reservists to support the military campaign. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, the U.S. Central Bank has raised interest rates again in a bid to curb the country's highest inflation in 40 years, which has been stoking fears of a recession. The Fed has made it clear that it will stick to its aggressive monetary policy to battle soaring prices. Experts believe that rising the benchmark lending rate would slow down the economy, but put a question mark on the credibility of the bank itself. The Fed has already increased interest rates three times in a row. American families and businesses are feeling the heat of skyrocketing prices that have also become a political liability for President Joe Biden ahead of the midterm congressional elections. Wall Street stocks fell sharply after the Fed enacted another three-quarter point interest rate hike and signaled more monetary tightening ahead. The Dow Jones Industrial Average finished down 1.7%, while the broad-based S&P 500 also shed 1.7%. The Nasdaq Composite Index declined 1.8%. In the meantime, recent data shows that the cost of renting a house is sharply rising in the United States, pushing already high consumer prices even higher. According to the Census Bureau figures, household rents in 2021 jumped 10% from the pre-pandemic levels. This as year-on-year increases, and the median household rent stood at 2 to 3% over the past decade. The surge in rents has forced many people to take on additional jobs or roommates to afford housing costs. Among those affected are recent college students, college graduates, and younger workers. The surge, however, is not restricted to those groups or small homes. Larger properties saw even a bigger increase of almost 12% at the end of 2021 and the start of 2022. The figure is about three times of what it was in the previous year and the 5 years leading to the pandemic. To discuss that further, we're joined by Paul Sheldon, food professor from the California State University. If you could please shed more light on the economic situation in the United States, how this situation has affected the average family in the U.S.?
This time it'll affect a different group of people, as you noted, some of them. It'll also affect young people who want to marry and raise families in houses. They'll have to delay their timing for buying a house. It will affect anyone in the lower end of the income level or retirement level, because they didn't have stock going up over the last 10 years in their portfolios. And so while some people in the middle and upper groups are unhappy to see their portfolios drop by 20%, that doesn't mean a whole lot, because they also saw them go up by much more than that. But for the lower part of the economy, it hurts. And it's going to hurt for investors, young investors who want to start saving. So lots of people will be hurt in many different ways.
And Professor, does this hurting have any positive result? Will it lead to something good, at least in the end?
Well, the only thing good that's likely to come out of this is you don't want to have a country in which people just assume that there'll be inflation forever. You saw that happen in the South American countries, for example, where people were running off about every hour from their work to the bank to move their money into another account. You don't want to live in that kind of world. So that'll be the good news, is that inflation will come under control. The point, though, is the price will be paid to achieve that. A lot of people lose jobs. There'll be fewer job openings, and so they're paying for the sins of the last 10 years. The Federal Reserve ran a party with nearly zero interest rates, and that benefited the wealthier people. It did not benefit retired people or people who wanted to put money in savings accounts or certificates of deposits. So in any of these events, there are always winners and losers, and just a question of who wins and who loses.
Thank you very much, Paul Sheldon Foote, professor at the California State University, for sharing your thoughts and views with us.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
King Charles has ascended to the British throne at a time when people in the countries that were once exploited by the British wish the monarchy fade away soon. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned, please. Asia Times wrote, "The death of Queen Elizabeth, the longest-serving monarch of British royalty, has sparked global fascination and spawned thousands of clickbait reports of the details of her funeral. Americans who centuries ago rejected monarchy are seemingly obsessed with the ritualism, bizarrely mourning the demise of an elderly and fabulously wealthy woman who was born into privilege and who died of natural causes at the ripe old age of 96 across the ocean. Perhaps this is because popular and long-running TV shows about British royalty like The Crown have convinced that we know intimate details about the royals, and worse, they cause us to believe we should care about a family that is a symbolic marker of past imperial grandeur. But for those who are descended from the subjects of British imperialist conquest, the Queen, her ancestors, and her descendants represent the ultimate evil empire. One could argue that Elizabeth, who was gifted the throne and its title in 1952, did not lead an aggressive empire of conquest and instead presided over an institution that, under her rule, became largely symbolic and ceremonial in nature. And indeed, many do just that. Raoul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and the New Crusade, has a different opinion, referring in an interview to Elizabeth as a morally unremarkable person with a job that involved doing extremely unremarkable things. Mahajan explains further, saying that this was a highly privileged person given an opportunity to influence world events in some degree, which she had to do nothing to earn, who never did anything particularly remarkable, innovative, or insightful. While Elizabeth's 7 years on the throne were mostly spent overseeing an ostensible unraveling of British Empire in a world less intolerant of occupation, enslavement, and imperial plunder, just a few months into her role as queen, the British violently put down the Mau Mau rebellion in Kenya. According to New York Times, a story about how citizens in African nations today have little sympathy for the dead monarch, the squashing of the rebellion led to the establishment of a vast system of detention camps and torture, rape, castration, and killing of thousands of people. Even if Elizabeth was not responsible for directing the horrors, they were carried out in her name. Over the 7 decades that she wielded symbolic power, she never once apologized for what was done during her rule in Kenya, or indeed what was done in her family's name in dozens of other nations in the global south. It's no wonder that black and brown people the world over have openly expressed disgust at the collective fawning of such an ugly legacy. Professor Uju Anya of Carnegie Mellon University, who is Nigerian, is under fire for her frank dismissal of Elizabeth after posting on Twitter that she heard the chief monarch of a thieving and raping genocidal empire is finally dying. May her pain be excruciating. Kehinde Andrews, a black studies professor at Birmingham City University, wrote on Politico that he cannot relate to his fellow Britons' desire to mourn Elizabeth, a woman he considered to be the number one symbol of white supremacy and a manifestation of the institutional racism that we have to encounter on a daily basis. According to the New York Times, as Prince Charles used tax breaks, offshore accounts, and canny real estate investments to turn a sleepy state into a billion-dollar business. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists in 2017 found that both Elizabeth and Charles were named in the leaked Paradise Papers, indicating that they hid their money in havens to avoid paying taxes. Fleecing taxpayers and living off stolen wealth, monarchy's original modus operandi appears to be central to Elizabeth's legacy. One, she passes on to her son, who also won't pay an inheritance tax on the wealth she left him. The British monarchy, according to Mahajan, mostly represents a real concession to the idea that some people are just born better and more important than you, and you should look to them. It's a good time for the popularity of this institution to fade away soon.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program, The Muslim Lady. This is your host, Zainab, and I have with me Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
A very warm welcome, Siddiqa.
Thank you very much.
Dear listeners, Siddiqa is a student of jurisprudence in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom, and she's also a researcher. She researches a lot on the issues related to women. Well, we have this issue which is called as OCD in short, or shall I say obsessive compulsive disorder, a topic which is sometimes misunderstood, or people have little information about that. I would want you to shed some light on that.
Okay. So first, the whole point of discussing it on a women's show is the reason I wanted to sort of look into this is because it is largely misunderstood, and especially in Islamic world. And because it is misunderstood in the Islamic world, the services available are limited. It is misunderstood because it is a relatively new phenomena, and it's not something we've seen before in such large numbers as it is happening today. Now, given that I work with a lot of scholars from around the world as part of my other jobs, I keep on seeing a trend of people coming in with questions that they show symptoms of OCD, which is why it becomes so important to discuss it.
Yeah.
And how within an Islamic framework we can go about resolving these issues. Now, women generally, when it comes to OCD, a lot of women would see eating disorders as part of the OCD, but that's not all. First, I'll define OCD. So OCD is an obsessive compulsive disorder, which is now seen as a mental health issue, and it can severely affect a person's home life, relationship, daily life, and basically a person's day-to-day life becomes extremely hard. Now, OCD, there are different symptoms of it. Some of them are what, first, in the Islamic world. Now, when I mean Islamic world, I mean the scholars. The scholars I have come across, now here I'm stressing on who I have come across, and they just take it as doubts, like excessive washing, repeating your wudu several times, you know, repeating the namaz several times. They just place it under that category because...
The category of doubt.
Yes, because OCD is a disease that you would have to physically go through it to understand what it is. Otherwise, it becomes quite... It is a mental health issue. Now, some of the symptoms of OCD can be the fear of germs and contamination, which is what it's generally understood as by the scholars who I have come across. And then there are the much more worse forms. Some of them would be very intrusive thoughts about religion, intrusive thoughts about violence. Now, when I talk about this, I'll give an example of what I have seen.
So here you completely differentiated it. from the doubts, because yes, you came to thoughts now.
Yes. Now, what people generally understood OCD as just doubts, or, you know, doing something constantly. Like, I remember one of my friends was like, I have OCD about cleaning my kitchen. I'm like, that's not OCD. You just need a clean kitchen, right?
Okay.
That's different. Now, that was her case, obviously. But then there's some people who, when it comes to germs and contamination, it's how we generally understand OCD. Is the minute they touch something, they need to go wash their hands, which is how OCD is generally understood as. But because there are other levels which can be very severely difficult to deal with, like thoughts.
Okay.
Now, for example,
now it's becoming a little more interesting because you're getting deeper into the topic. We're actually understanding what it is. We would like to know more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm with Sadiqa and we're discussing about OCD. Yes, Sadiqa, you were actually explaining it you're throwing a deep, deep light into the issue.
So when it comes to, so like we discussed, there's one level of fears of germs and contamination, and then it goes to the thoughts. Now, the thoughts, from what I've seen with people coming to us with, like I said, I work with a range of scholars who are quite into the communities, and the questions that they get constantly, and I have seen this trend increasing within the Islamic world, is that people would say they have intrusive thoughts about, I'm sorry, I'm using a very graphic example, but it's only to get the message home.
Yeah.
Okay. Then they think that they are the ones who are wrong, that I have made a sin by thinking.
Okay.
Right? Generally, till now, from what I've read, psychologists have not really been able to pinpoint a specific cause for OCD, but because people have these intrusive thoughts, would have thoughts about violence towards themselves or others, or they would imagine themselves harming their family, even though they don't want to do it. It's not from themselves.
Just
a thought. They do not put it into action.
Then they feel regretful towards their thoughts as well.
Yes, and then it becomes a cycle. The thought comes, and the funny thing about OCD is, and it is very, very difficult to handle, is that it is so intrusive that if you do not concede to it, it will not leave you. And this is what people go through when it comes to OCD. Until they do not concede to it in their mind, it will not leave them. And when they do concede to it, they feel this sense of relief in them. Then the guilt comes in.
Okay.
Then it's a chain. Then again, after again. And from what I've kind of understood is that people go through this OCD as a result of immense pressure in their lives, especially which is seen during the childhood years, either through assault, different forms of assault, growing up in households which were not very stable, mm-hmm, or just seeing intensive pressures in the childhood years.
Or any kind of trauma they went
through. Yeah, any trauma would then, to an extent, cause OCD. Now, in women, OCD is generally diagnosed a bit later.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they haven't really pinpointed, but it could be a reason that women do not openly speak about these issues so much faster.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it just starts to show itself later in women.
Now, since you yourself said that women do not speak about it themselves, or they do not openly talk about it, what could be done about it? I'll ask you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
We're talking about OCD. Sadiqa, we went through OCD. We differentiated it with doubts, and we gave some Islamic examples. And now you came to women.
Yes. So there are other forms of OCD, but because I have come across the intrusive thoughts so much, and given that I do not feel that this part of OCD is openly discussed within the Islamic circles, and therefore I do feel that there's an importance for us to get it out and get people the help they need. Now, even these intrusive thoughts can sometimes be in the form of them doubting. They do not doubt the existence of Allah, right? But they doubt, their thoughts make them feel that they doubt the existence of Allah. It's a very hard,
difficult situation.
The situation for them.
Sometimes it may lead you to doubt your faith.
Yeah, they do not have doubts about Allah. They do not have any doubts in their faith.
But this feeling.
They're very religious people. But those thoughts, which are not, they do not align themselves to those thoughts. That's another thing. They do not feel those thoughts are coming from them. It is something that is within them that is coming in the form of an obsessive
compulsive disorder
that is very difficult for them to separate from themselves. And because it is mental, they have to go about their daily life while having to deal with this. And at some point, they can't do it. And therefore, some people do go for suicide, which shows the extremity of this issue. So I had spoken to my teacher about it, right? My teacher is a teacher in jurisprudence. And I asked her about these issues. And her answer was simple. These thoughts, because it is a mental disorder, these thoughts do not entail any sin on the person. So if you go through these thoughts at any point, just know that you're not going to be sinned for it.
It's okay.
Yes. But that does not mean that you should not get the help you need.
All right.
Right?
So there you go. You don't have to feel regretful about it. You don't have to, you have not committed a sin if a thought is just coming in. But at the same time, you need to seek help.
Yes, because if a person does not seek help, it can be very lifelong. I know of people who've gone through this for 15 odd years. And later they were able to seek help. And the reason they went through it for 15 years was because they were afraid to speak of it, given that it is such a taboo subject. It is a subject that people do not discuss. And if a person is having anti-religious thoughts, they do not align to themselves, but because they're so scared of speaking out about it, because people might say that these people have left their religion.
How can he think about it? How can she think about it?
Exactly. And they're so scared of speaking about it that they don't speak about it. And then the issue goes on for many years, and the help that they could have easily gotten is the chances lost, basically. So, yes, just making sure that the help is got. And there are different helps available, which we can discuss.
All right, so any anti-religious thought coming into your mind and you're not speaking about it openly can actually lead into problems. You should speak about it, seek help.
Seek
from
help
a counselor.
From counselors, yes. All that's right. One way of seeking help.
So what do you do with women over here?
Okay, so the methods of getting help for OCD, one of them is going to a psychologist or a counselor. I would recommend an Islamic counselor who's able to help you get through, especially if those issues are religious-based. It would be helpful to go through an Islamic psychologist or a counselor who's able to walk you through methods of containing these thoughts such that they do not overly burden your life. And then there are other methods. Some of them are like meditation. Meditation has seemed to help a few people who I know. I'm talking about an Islamic form of meditation over here. When they're doing yoga, they utter the term Om, which is a Hindu god.
Yeah.
But an Islamic form of meditation, it is a meditation which is you relax the mind, but it also by uttering the word Allah. So bringing that focus within yourself towards Allah to bring the mind some calm and peace.
All right. Thank you so much, Siddiqa, for being with us. Thank you so much for explaining actually what OCD is. Now in another session, would like to continue and give more examples from women, basically. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illa Allah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
China plans to warmly invite Taiwan back into its arms. The Chinese acted with soft power by increasing trade and tourism between the two countries. A soft power approach amounts to persuading the Taiwanese people that there is no reason to fear reunification with the motherland. We now present you an article written by Mohammad Reza Jofar, an expert in geopolitics. The piece is titled Soft Power, China's Strategy for Taiwan. The geostrategic atmosphere in the South China Sea has been tense following the recent visit to Taiwan by U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. This brought to the fore the issue of China's marine embargo and Beijing's need to access strategic straits in East Asia, which have been traditionally controlled by allies of the U.S., including Japan, the Philippines, and Indonesia. China's eastern and northeastern ports are limited to marine routes that go through the Sea of Japan and the East China Sea. On the south and southeast, Chinese ships have to cross the Malacca and Sunda Straits in the Philippines and Indonesia to access international waters. Therefore, Beijing attaches great importance to facilitating the transit of its ships and the possible escalation of tension between China and these countries over marine routes has been a subject of discussion by experts in geopolitics over the past two decades. There is an archipelago between China and the Pacific Ocean, which Beijing calls the first island chain that falls within the limits of its territory. China's relations with its neighbors have been damaged over the ownership of more than 200 small coral islands. These sea passages provide access to some of the world's most important shipping routes through the South China Sea. China is trying to gain control of all these passages because it fears that at a time of heightened tensions, it may lose access to them. Japan has been a major impediment to China's free access to the Pacific Ocean. Look at the existing sea routes shows that when Chinese ships leave the Yellow Sea and circle the Korean Peninsula, they have to cross the Sea of Japan and La Perouse Strait before gaining access to the Pacific Ocean. Most of this area falls within the marine territories of Japan or Russia and may be close to China in times of heightened tension. Even if the Chinese cross the strait, they must still go through the Kuril Islands to the northeast of Hokkaido, which are collectively controlled by Russia but claimed by Japan. Although China and Japan have many border disputes, their row over La Perouse Strait is the most important one, which restricts China's shipping in the northern and eastern waters of the country. Taiwan, whose official name is the Republic of China, is also known as the Chinese Taipei, National China, and Formosa. It is a region in East Asia comprised of the islands of Taiwan, Penghu, Kinmen, Matsu, and a number of other small islands. All of them are located off China's eastern coast. Via its sea borders, this island nation neighbors the People's Republic of China on the west, Japan on the northeast, and the Philippines on the south. Taiwan is located below Okinawa, in the South China Sea, and is away from mainland China. Chinese officials consider it as their country's 23rd province. However, it is currently an ally of the United States, and its naval and air forces are equipped with American weaponry. Taiwan went under China's ownership in the 17th century. According to the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979, the United States is committed to defending Taiwan in case of a Chinese attack. However, this will not be the case if Taiwan declares its separation from the mainland, as a secessionist policy by Taiwan is considered a major provocation and will be deemed an act of war by China. Both governments strive to gain official recognition for themselves, and it is Beijing that has been mostly successful in this regard. With a population of 1.4 billion against Taiwan's 23 million, China enjoys more power of persuasion and geopolitical clout than Taiwan. The Chinese do not want Taiwan to be able to vie militarily with Beijing. Instead, they have acted with soft power by increasing trade and tourism between the two countries. China plans to warmly invite Taiwan back into its arms, a soft war approach amounts to persuading the Taiwanese people that there is no reason to fear reunification with the motherland. China's general policy is to try to maintain good relations with most of its bordering countries so as not to allow any separation movement to be organized or supported. What is certain is that China will never let go of Taiwan due to geopolitical reasons, because Taiwan is both a commercial and an energy transit route and a buffer zone for China against the Pacific Ocean. Also, it is not unlikely that China's failure to govern Taiwan will trigger widespread internal unrest that will threaten the Communist Party's influence and China's unity, because if the Chinese government accepts Taiwan's separation from the mainland, it is possible that the suburban and marginal areas would enter into a conflict with the central government in Beijing. This, in turn, would also bring the buffer zones into the conflict. Nevertheless, in a situation where China's military power is on the rise, Taiwan and the United States will show less desire for a military conflict. For Beijing, Taiwan is a small threat that can be managed. Now that China is the second largest economy in the world, it has a global advantage. Beijing has the initiative, and in the event of any sanctions or war, the United States will suffer more than any other country. While the European Union was the main victim of the sanctions regime against Russia, the situation is completely different in the case of China. Moreover, the international community will not be able to take the brunt of sanctions against China. China views Taiwan through a geopolitical security lens, and they would naturally assume that the Westerners are trying to harm China's security. However, China's security will not be compromised. Political geography and realities on the ground are against Taiwan's secessionist policy. It should be noted that China will not show much flexibility in the case of a blockade of the existing sea routes, such as the Sunda Strait, the Taiwan Strait, and the Malacca Strait, through which 80% of China's energy resources pass. In case such policies are implemented, an all-out crisis will occur in the South China Sea. Beijing intends to dissuade its neighbors from getting close to the United States and change the opinion and method of the United States as well. Therefore, it is investing in deep water ports in these regions, an investment that would bring China closer relations, trade connections, and the possibility of friendly bases in other countries for naval deployment. China considers Taiwan as a breakaway province that should be reunited with the mainland under the internationally recognized One China policy. Under that policy, nearly all countries recognize Beijing's sovereignty over the island, including the United States of America, which has no formal diplomatic ties with the territory. However, in violation of its own stated policy and in an attempt to irritate Beijing, Washington continues to court the secessionist government in Taipei. Supporting its anti-China stance, and supplying it with massive caches of armaments. In flaming tensions between the United States and China, the 82-year-old Nancy Pelosi stepped in Taiwan on 2nd of August, prompting Beijing to react to the highest-level U.S. visit to Taiwan in 25 years, with a burst of military activity in the island's surrounding waters. Recently, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said at a press conference in Beijing that China would resolutely fight back against every U.S. provocative act that undermines its sovereignty and territorial integrity and meddles with its domestic affairs. Warning of the escalation in tensions, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said, "Pelosi's trip to Taiwan is a major political provocation to upgrade U.S.-Taiwan exchanges. The United States conducts up to 100 military exercises in China's surrounding waters every year, but accuses China of overreacting." China will not accept this thuggish logic, nor will the international community. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman, Wang Wenbin, also noted that every time the American side makes a serious provocative act of infringing on China's sovereignty and interfering in China's internal affairs, the Chinese side will resolutely fight back. China will never allow its sovereignty and territorial integrity to be wantonly trampled upon and sabotaged.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.